32. Post-acute. The waitress was departing with orders, taking the hardbound menus with her, when a disturbance broke out at a table on the opposite side of the room. Raised voices. A tall, broad-shouldered, black-clad young man, pale features grimly set, suddenly standing, knocking over his chair. Milgram watched as this one swept for the door, slamming out of Les Editeurs, to be met by a tide of electronic flash, flinging up his arm to protect his eyes or hide his face. "That didn't take long," said George, who was buttering a round of sliced baguette. He had elegantly hairy hands, like some expensive Austrian stuffed animal. He bit off half of the buttered bread with his large white teeth. "All he could stand," said Meredith, someone whose intelligence protruded through her beauty, Milgram felt, like the outline of unforgiving machinery pressing against a taut silk scarf. Craning his neck, Milgram made out one of the daughters, silver hair unmistakable, at the table the young man had deserted. After the liquid metal penguin, this didn't seem so odd. He felt as though he were on some kind of roll today. She was collecting her things, he saw. She checked the dial of her enormous gold wristwatch. "Saw them," he said, "the daughters, on the river, in a video." He turned back to George. "I saw you too." "It's about an album launch," said George. "They have a new release. We don't, but share a label." "Who is that who left?"
"Bram," said Hollis, "the singer from the Stokers."
"Don't know him," said Milgram, picking up one of the rounds of bread in order to give his hands something to do.
"You aren't 13, said Meredith, "are you?"
"No," agreed Milgram, putting the slice of bread, whole, into his mouth. Oral, his therapist called that. She'd said he was very lucky to never have taken up smoking. The bread was firm, springy. He held it there a moment before he began to chew. Meredith was staring at him. He looked back at the Bronstadter table, where someone was holding whichever daughter's chair as she rose. That person was Rausch, he saw, and almost spat out the bread. Desperately, he found Hollis's eye. She winked, the sort of effortless wink that involves no other features, a wink that Milgram himself could never have managed, and took a sip of wine.
"George is in a band, Milgram," she said, and he knew that she spoke to calm him. "The Bollards. Reg Inchmail, who is the guitarist in The Curfew with me, is producing their new album."
Milgram, chewing and swallowing the suddenly dry bread, nodded, took a sip of water, coughed into his crisp cloth napkin. What was Rausch doing here? He glanced back, but didn't see Rausch. The daughter, reaching the door, triggered a second wave of strobing, a raggedly cumulative brilliance, the color of her hair. He looked back to Hollis. She nodded, almost invisibly. George and Meredith, he guessed, were unaware of her connection with Blue Ant, or, for that matter, of his own. The daughters, he knew, were Blue Ant clients, or rather, their father, whom Milgram had never seen, was some kind of major Big Ant project, possibly even partner. Some people, Rausch included, assumed Big Ant's interest in the sisters was sexual, but Milgram, from his intermittently privileged position as Big Ant's conversational foil, guessed that not to be the case. Big Ant cheerfully squired the twins through London, as though they were a pair of tedious but astronomically valuable dogs, the property of someone he wished above most things to favorably impress.
"The Stokers are on a different label," explained George, "but one owned by the same firm. The publicists have set up a fake romance between Bram and Friedrika, but have also floated the rumor that Bram and Ides are involved."
"It's a very old tactic," said Meredith, "and particularly obvious with identical twins."
"Though new to their audience and Bram's," said George, "who, as you point out, are 13 years old.
Milgram looked at Hollis. She looked back, smiled, telling Milgram that this was not the time to ask questions. She shrugged out of her hound's jacket, leaving it draped stiffly across the back of her chair. She was wearing a dress the color of weathered coal, a gray that was almost black, a clingy knit. He looked at Meredith's dress for the first time. It was black, a thick, shiny fabric,
the detailing sewn like an antique work shirt. He didn't understand women's clothing, but he thought he recognized something. "Your dress," he said to Meredith. "It's very nice. Thank you. Is it Gabriel Hounds?" Meredith's eyebrows rose fractionally. She looked from Milgram to Hollis, then back to Milgram. "Yes," she said, "it is." "It's lovely," said Hollis. "This season's?" "They don't do seasons." "But recent?" Hollis looking very seriously at Meredith over the rim of her upraised wine glass. "Dropped last month." "Melbourne?" "Tokyo." "Another art fair?" Hollis finished the wine in her glass. George poured for her, pointed the neck of the bottle questioningly at Milgram, then saw Milgram's inverted glass. "A bar. Tibetan-themed micro-bistro. I never quite grasped where. Basement of an office building. Owner sleeps up above the fake rafters he put in, though that's a secret. Hounds haven't often done things specifically for women. A knit skirt that nobody's ever been able to copy, though everyone tries. Your jacket's unisex, though you'd never know it, on. Something to do with those elastic straps in the shoulders." She looked annoyed, Milgram thought, but very much in control. "Would it be out of line to ask how you knew to be there?" Their first courses arrived, and Meredith waited for the waitress to leave before answering. When she did, she seemed more relaxed. "I'm not directly connected," she said to Hollis. "I've been out of touch with that friend I told you about, the one I knew at Cordwainer's, for a few years now. But he'd introduced me to someone else. I'm not in touch with them either, and don't know how to contact them. But they put me on a mailing list. I get an email if there's going to be a drop. I don't know that I get them for every drop, but there's no way of knowing that. They aren't frequent. Since I took Clammy to buy his jeans in Melbourne, there have only been two emails, Prague and Tokyo. I happened to be in Tokyo, well, Osaka. I went along." "What were they offering?" "Let's eat," said Meredith. "Shall we?" "Of course," said Hollis. Milgram's was salmon and very good. The waitress had let him order from an English translation of the menu. He looked around, trying to spot Roush again, but didn't see him. A shift in clientele was still underway as people who had actually only been there, he guessed, for Bram's exit, signaled for their bills and departed, some leaving untouched food. Tables were being quickly cleared, reset, and reseated. The noise level was going up. "I wouldn't want either of you to think I'll be any less willing to help you with inch mail," said Hollis, "regardless of what you may or may not be able to tell me about Hounds." Milgram saw George glance quickly at Meredith. "We appreciate that," George said, though Milgram wasn't sure that Meredith did. Perhaps George was using the band, "we." "All you really need with inch mail is someone to tell you where you are in his process," Hollis said. "And that's all I can do anyway. You can't change the process, and if you try hard enough, long enough, he'll leave. So far, you're right on track." None of this meaning anything to Milgram, who was enjoying the salmon and some light chilled sauce. "I'm sorry," Meredith said, "but you're going to have to tell us who you're working for." "If I were better at this sort of thing," said Hollis, "I'd start by telling you about my book. It's about locative art." "I don't know the term," Meredith said. "It's what they're calling augmented reality now," said Hollis. "But art. It's been around since before the iPhone started to become the default platform. That was when I wrote about it. But I meant that if I were going to lie to you, I'd tell you about that, then tell you that I was writing another on esoteric denim or mad marketing strategies. But I won't. I'm working for Hubertus Bigand." The last bite of salmon caught in Milgram's throat. He drank water, coughed into his napkin. "Are you choking?" asked George, who looked as though he could perform a really optimal Heimlich maneuver. "No, thanks," said Milgram. "Blue Ant?" asked Meredith. "No," said Hollis. "We're freelance. Bigand wants to know who's behind Gabriel Hounds." "Why?" Meredith had put down her fork. "Possibly because he thinks someone's outdoing him at something he considers to have been his own game. Or so he suggested. Do you know him?" "Only by reputation," said Meredith. Is Blue Ant doing your band's publicity? Milgram asked George, after some more water.
Not that I know of, said George. Too small a world already.
I'm not a Blue Ant employee, said Hollis. Big Ant's hired me to look into Gabriel Hounds. He wants to know who designs it, how their anti-marketing scheme works. I'm only prepared to go so far. I'm not prepared to lie to you about it.
How about you? Meredith asked Milgram.
I don't have a badge, Milgram said.
What do you mean?
To open the door, Milgram said, at Blue Ant. Employees have those badges. I'm not on salary.
First course dishes were removed. Second courses arrived. Milgram's was pork tenderloin, stacked like a corpulent chess piece, a rook of pork. It toppled as he began to eat it.
How badly does Big Ann want to know? Meredith's knife and fork were poised.
He wants to know everything, basically, said Hollis, all the time. Right now, he wants to know this quite badly. Next month, maybe not so much.
He must have a lot of resources for information.
Meredith cut into a roundel of beef.
Prides himself on it, Hollis said.
I mentioned that I believe most of my last season of shoes are in a warehouse in Seattle, Tacoma, possibly.
Yes.
I don't know where. Can't find them. The lawyers say they could make a very convincing case for my ownership if we could locate them. We're fairly certain they haven't been sold off. Otherwise, at least a few would have surfaced on eBay. None have. Could Big Ann find them for me?
I don't know, said Hollis.
But if he couldn't, I don't know who could.
I don't know what I could find out for you, said Meredith. But assuming I found something, I'd consider an exchange. Otherwise, not.
Milgram looked from Meredith to Hollis, back.
I'm not authorized to make that sort of deal, said Hollis. But I can certainly take him the proposal.
This reminded Milgram of the closing rhythm of certain very backstage drug deals, the kind in which one party may know of someone with an Aerostar van full of some precursor chemical, while another is aware of the approximate whereabouts of a really efficient pill-pressing machine.
Please do, said Meredith, smiling, then taking a first sip of her wine.
That was very good, Milgram said to Hollis, after saying goodnight to Meredith and George outside the restaurant. The timing.
When you told them about Big Ant.
What choice did I have?
If I told them otherwise, I'd already have been lying to them. The hotel's this way.
I was never good at that sort of timing, said Milgram. Then remembered the penguin and glanced up.
What was that about UFOs when you first walked in?
I don't know, said Milgram. I thought I'd seen something. It's been a long day.
I have your computer. Would you mind if I kept it overnight?
I have to check something.
It doesn't matter, said Hollis. I only have it for a book I haven't started writing. I have my iPhone.
What did you think you saw?
It looked like a penguin.
Hollis stopped.
A penguin? Where?
In the street. That way. He pointed.
In the street?
Flying.
They can't fly, Milgram.
Swimming, through the air. Level with the second-story windows, using its flippers to propel itself. But it looked more like a penguin-shaped blob of mercury. It reflected the lights, distorted them. It may have been a hallucination.
Do you get those?
P-A-W-S, said Milgram, spelling it out.
Pause?
Post-acute withdrawal syndrome. He shrugged, started for the hotel again, Hollis following. They were worried about that.
Who were?
The doctors, in the clinic, in Basel.
What about the man at the salon? The one in the pants? The one you thought you'd seen in Selfridges? Did he follow you?
Yes. Slight was telling him where I was.
What happened?
I don't know.
Why not?
I left the Neo with someone else. He followed them.
He needed to clean his teeth. There was pergolette between his upper rear molars. It still tasted good.
It's been a long day, said Hollis, as they reached what he took to be their hotel.
I spoke with Hubertus. He wants you to call him. Slight thinks you've run away.
I feel like I have. He held the door for her.
Thank you, she said.
Monsieur Milgram?
A man,
behind a vaguely pulpit-like counter.
"Mr. Milgram's room is on my card," said Hollis.
"Yes," said the clerk, "but he must still register."
He produced a printed white card and a pen.
"Your passport, please."
Milgram brought out his Faraday pouch, then his passport.
"I'll call you in the morning, in time for breakfast here, then the train," said Hollis.
"Good night."
And she was gone, around a corner.
"I will photocopy this," said the clerk,
"and return it to you when you are finished in the lobby."
He gestured with his head to Milgram's right.
"The lobby?"
"Where the young lady is waiting."
"Young lady?"
But the clerk had vanished through a narrow doorway behind the counter. The lights were out in the small lobby. Folding wooden panels partially screened it from the reception area. Streetlight reflected on china, set out for breakfast service, and on the yellow curve of the helmet from the low oval of a glass coffee table. A small figure rose smoothly to its feet in a complex rustle of waterproof membranes and cycle armor.
"I'm Fiona,"
she said sternly, her jawline delicate above the stiff, buckled collar. She stuck out her hand. Milgram shook it automatically. It was small, warm, strong, and calloused.
"Milgram."
"I know that."
She didn't sound British.
"Are you American?"
"Technically, you too. We both work for Big Ant."
He told Hollis he wasn't sending anybody.
"Blue Ant didn't send anybody. I work for him. So do you."
"How do I know you really work for Big Ant?" She tapped the face of a phone like Hollis's, listened, handed it to him.
"Hello,"
said Big Ant.
"Milgram?"
"Yes."
"How are you?"
Milgram considered. "It's been a long day."
"Run it past Fiona after we've spoken. She'll relay it to me."
"Did you have Slight tracking me with the Neo?"
"It's part of what he does. He called from Toronto. Said you'd left Paris."
"I slipped someone the phone."
"Slight's wrong," Big Ant said.
"Not about the phone leaving Paris."
"That's not what I mean. He's wrong."
"Okay," said Milgram. "Who's right?"
"Pamela," said Big Ant. "Fiona, whom you've just met. We'll be keeping it at that until the situation sorts itself out."
"Is Hollis?"
"Hollis is unaware of any of this."
"Am I?"
There was a silence. "Interesting question," said Big Ant, finally. "What do you think?"
"I don't like Slight. Don't like the man he had following me."
"You're doing well. More proactive than I asked for, but that's interesting."
"I saw a penguin. Penguin-shaped. Something. I may need to go back to the clinic."
"That's our Festo Air Penguin," Big Ant said, after a pause. "We're experimenting with it as an urban video surveillance platform."
"Festive?"
"Festo. They're German."
"What's going on, please?"
"Something that happens periodically. It has to do with the kind of talent Blue Ant requires. If they're any good at what I hire them for, they tend to have an innate tendency to go rogue. That or sell out to someone who already has. I expect this to happen. It can actually be quite productive. Fiona was on the train with you this morning. She'll be on the train back tomorrow. Put Hollis in a cab to Cabinet."
"What's that?"
"Where she's staying. Then wait near the cab rank. Fiona will bring you to me. Give her a rundown of your day now, then get some sleep."
"Okay," Milgram said, then realized Big Ant was gone. He handed the phone back to Fiona, noticing that she wore something on her left wrist, about 6 inches long, that looked like a doll's computer keyboard. "What's that?"
"Controls the penguin," she said. "But we're switching over to iPhones for that."